Welcome to the Preservation Technology Podcast. I'm Kevin Ammons. Today I'm visiting with Ruth Tringham, one of the founders of the UC Berkeley Multimedia Authoring Center for Teaching in Anthropology. Professor of Anthropology at the University of California at Berkeley, Ruth uses an online virtual environment called Second Life in her teaching. Welcome, Ruth. How did you find yourself at Berkeley exploring the notion of Second Life as an archaeological tool?
Well, it sort of developed out of my work with digital forms of visualization, things like multimedia, 3D modeling, and of Neolithic archaeological sites in Southeast Europe and then Anatolia more recently with Çatalhöyük. And I was, I actually didn't know anything about Second Life. It must have been in the early 2000s because I'd been doing this visualization multimedia stuff for all through the 90s, at least the last part of the 90s. But then I was working with this digital technologist, I suppose. He's not really that. He's somebody who's worked with museums and digital technology called Noah Whitman. He started working with us on a project called Remixing Çatalhöyük. And I can tell you about that a little later. But while we were working on that, which was really a method of sharing our Çatalhöyük media database with the public, he introduced me to Second Life. He said, "Have you seen this? You might be interested in this." And so I, of course, immediately said, "Oh my God, yes, this is exactly what I've been waiting for." And it was. And it was early in 2007 that our team at UC Berkeley, with the students, archaeologists, and media specialists, began using Second Life to develop a virtual reconstruction of this iconic Neolithic settlement at Çatalhöyük in present-day Turkey. And the way this project was conceived was as complementary to this concurrent project of Remixing Çatalhöyük, which is this online exhibition and resource. So we purchased our virtual island. We were so enthusiastic about it that we actually purchased a virtual land thanks to our contacts in the UC Berkeley's Information Technology Service. And we were especially thankful of the support of this guy called David Greenbaum. And we named it Okapi Island, which might seem weird because what have okapis, which is an East African animal, got to do with Çatalhöyük in Turkey? So, but Okapi Island is actually named after our sponsor, which is the Open Knowledge and the Public Interest Program, who that was our program that was creating this Remixing Çatalhöyük, the sharing of Çatalhöyük through open knowledge software, open knowledge, the idea that all of our data should be shareable through a Creative Commons license, a share-alike attribution, but no, well, it's ambiguous whether we would allow it for commercial. But the point is that these media and the data and everything else that we do is shareable without the constriction of a copyright royalty type of license. So that was what Okapi Island is all about as well. So the team meets face-to-face. The Okapi Island team meets face-to-face every week in our computer laboratory called the MACTIA, the Multimedia Authoring Center for Teaching in Anthropology at Berkeley. And in world, we meet on our virtual property in Second Life. Actually, currently, one of our undergraduate student team members is leading these meetings through teaching a decal course at Berkeley for 10 registered students. Decal course is short for democratization of teaching or something like that at Berkeley. So I sponsor this course, but I do it, since I'm on sabbatical, I do it in world in Second Life from my home. And I'm doing it along with my colleague and archaeology and new media doctoral student, Colleen Morgan. And she, Noah Whitman, and our longtime colleague Michael Ashley, and I find that Second Life has the potential as a way of embedding archaeological research, that is, its database and its interpretations, in a game-like environment.
What exactly is Second Life?
It's an online environment that has game-like immersion and social media functionality without game-like goals and rules. They say that at the heart is a sense of presence with others at the same time and in the same place. And I think that's a really good way of describing it. There's another definition which was provided by this group called Move Nation. Moves, I don't know if you know that, Second Life is a move. It stands for MUVE, that is. It stands for Massively Multi-User Virtual Environment. And there are others, there are other worlds like Second Life, but not as open. And they include things like Open Croquet, there's one called Open Sim, there's one called Twinity, and there's another called There, that is T-H-E-R-E, not T-H-E-I-R. And then there's another one called Caniva. I haven't actually visited any of these. I know that I have visited OpenSim, and it's although it's open source, unlike Second Life, which is proprietary, OpenSim has much of the characteristics and even the interface of Second Life, but it's actually a little more difficult to use.
What is it about Second Life that you think people find compelling?
I love that question. Because there are some things which are quite compelling, and it depends on who you are, whether you're going to find these things compelling. I find some of the compelling things I've talked a little about, the events, the meeting my colleagues and being able to talk to my colleagues in place in the second world, Second Life. I find this very compelling. I find the whole thing of creating a community of your island and of the people who come to visit, I find that really compelling. When I'm visiting a place, I find that one of the things that I hate are places that are empty. And there is something creepy about Second Life that will put people off. And that's that if there isn't any event going on, you go to visit a place, you're likely not to find anyone there, except perhaps some of these non-player sims, which are, I find, just as creepy as no one being there. So I find these empty places very, very repelling. And I don't know, the answer to that is perhaps to have constant events, or to at least have the idea that this island is not abandoned, that there are signs up. There's going to be an event here at such and such. We don't do this. We should. I wanted us to have an event, at some kind of an event, at least each month, and we haven't done that. We've had a couple each year, and I think that to really make an island popular and not repelling, you need to have some kind of activity there. For everyone, that everyone knows about each month. We tend to have this idea that the place is not empty, because that will put, you know, it'll put people off the creepiness of the empty places. I think going along with that is if you visit a place and there's nothing to do there, or nothing really, there's not much guidance there. You're not sure what's going on. You just sort of twitter around with birds, or rather you move around and birds are twittering, and oh, it's very beautiful, and the wind is rustling, and people say this is poetic, and oh, it's lovely, and so on. I don't find that myself very attractive. Many people do, but I don't. If there are assets that can be, or things like gestures or scripts are available for free, there are some sites like that. I find these are great. What I find repelling is where people are trying to make money out of their building, or even money out of something else, you know, something that they're actually trying to sell. I find the commercial sites quite repelling about Second Life. Some people don't. Some people find this is as fun as eBay or something like that. I'm not an eBay person, so you can see I don't really go for any of this buying in Second Life.
What can Second Life offer archaeology in the realm of interpretation that other traditional approaches cannot?
One of the things about Second Life is that you, as a resident, you can create your own game-like place, context. You can create buildings. You could create. They won't look as good as some of the game engines, but they are. You do have it in your power to create this environment, this built environment. And so that's one of the things which can really attract people, I think, like heritage professionals, possibly to use Second Life rather than to try to use something like some of the more famous game engines. I mean, the famous game engines, they are just beautiful. They are just they're fantastic. I would love to do that. But if you remember Myst is very beautiful, but it's the movement through it is for the most part quite clumsy.
Is this something that you imagine would be possible for archaeology when you embarked on your career as a new professor?
Okay, when I started excavating, or when I started being a professional archaeologist in the 1970s, I dreamed of being able to enter my data and write on my own computer. And so I dreamed of that. And in the 1980s, I got it. In the early 1980s, I got my own computer and I could enter my own data into an Excel or something like that, whatever the equivalent of Excel was later on. Anyway, in the 1980s, I dreamed I would be able to create models of Neolithic buildings in three dimensions, like architectural cardboard models, and that I would be able to model prehistoric scenes and actors. That's what I dreamed in the 1980s. And I got my dream in the 1990s. So in the 1990s, even in 2002, which is out of the 1990s, in that 2002, was I was at a conference in talking about game engines when there were these gamers at this. It was a conference called Seagraph Campfire, and I was invited to go there with Michael Ashley because we'd been working on these hypermedia opuses, or whatever one wants to call them, about archaeology and bringing in three-dimensional imagery into thinking about human past places in the past. And so we were invited to this 2002 conference, and there were all these gaming people and laser scanning people and just unbearably high-tech people who showed us what they could do. And then I went to another conference in 2003 in Vienna. Right, they were using Unreal to think about using that Unreal for archaeology. And I was dreaming, oh my God, it would be fantastic to use a gaming engine to try to think about all of the alternative paths that people could take through their the life histories that we'd got for them. You know, whether we were thinking about life histories of buildings and life histories of people and places and things for archaeology. And wouldn't it be great to put to embed these ideas into a game engine?
What was the most difficult thing for you in using Second Life for archaeological interpretation?
It is difficult. Like any building, like any modeling program, it has its challenges and it's frustrating, and it's. But you don't have to be a complete computer geek to be able to do it, which is what really makes it different from many of the other MUVEs, the moves. But it also makes it different from using the game engines. Game engines, you have to be a real computer specialist for that, and it's. You know, it means that it's into a very different sphere of money and interaction. Okay, so you have to pay for your Second Life Island if you want to build on it, but you actually can always visit some of these free building places to mess around in their sandboxes. You can come to a Carpi Island, build whatever you like in our sandbox. And it's big enough to experiment. You could build a small model of say the Presidio if you wanted.
Oh, wow.
So that can, so you don't have to have your own land to be able to build, which again makes it very different from many places. One of the things I'm always sorry about in Second Life is that I can't make life messy enough. I can't make the surfaces messy, but that's the same in any computer. They can't even make the places messy, even with all of the fancy game engine.
Ruth, thanks for joining us today. If you'd like to learn more about the National Center for Preservation Technology and Training, visit our website at www.ncptt.nps.gov. Until next time, goodbye, everybody.